You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Now, from the complex curved geometry of fractals to curving the geometry of space-time itself. Einstein's theory of general relativity tells us that the universe is pervaded by a four-dimensional space-time fabric that warps and bends around heavy objects like stars and planets. Astronomers have seen evidence of this by looking at how the path of light traveling past cosmic objects is bent as it travels to Earth. But it would be wonderful to test what happens as space-time bends closer to home. Unfortunately, no matter how many donuts I eat, I never seem to put on enough weight to measurably curve space-time.
But at least you're trying, Brendan. That's the main thing. Now, as you say, we can't usually see the effects of warping space-time in the lab, since we can't build a giant black hole in the laboratory, for instance.
Nor would we want to.
But physicist and FQXI member Sorin Parawanu at Aalto University in Finland has a way around the problem. He's building his own model of space-time using an array of squids.
Won't they wriggle around too much and ruin the experiment? I hope the poor creatures aren't harmed in any way.
Squids, Brendan, in this case, are superconducting quantum interference devices.
I don't know what those are exactly, but at least there would be fewer ethical issues in using them.
Basically, they enable Parawanu to build an artificial space-time in the lab, which could soon be used to test the nature of space-time on the smallest scales. This could help us see how it matches up with the predictions made by theories of quantum gravity. I met with Parawanu in March at a Quantum Foundations meeting in Arice, Italy, sponsored by COST. During a coffee break in the meeting, he told me about why he and his colleagues want to mimic a curved space-time in his lab, to help them gain a better understanding of quantum gravity, and also to help us learn about how the early universe expanded, in a process known as inflation.
We would need to understand really what happens when quantum physics and the general theory of relativity are merged together, or they are forced to act together in the same experimental context. And in nature, this happens only at the event horizon of a black hole, which unfortunately is inaccessible so far to some real experimental or observational tests. And so we simply want to recreate the same phenomenon in the lab somehow, to put together the predictions of quantum physics and those coming from having a curved space-time background.
And so in your laboratory, what is it that plays the role of space-time, and how do you go about curving it?
The type of samples that we are studying are made as an array of squids. And this creates effectively a one-dimensional space-time background for the one-dimensional propagating fields, which are photons that travel along this array of squids.
So you're going to have to remind me what SQUID stands for. I think it's superconducting quantum something device. So, you know, what is it and how is it you're able to kind of control its properties?
Well, SQUID is a quantum interferometer device which is simply made of two Josephson junctions that are realized in parallel. So you tune externally some magnetic field, the magnetic field that pierces the SQUID loop, and this changes the effective Josephson energy, which in turn enters in the calculation of the speed of light that propagates in this chain of, in this array of squids, which in turn gives you the metric. The speed of light enters as the metric of the space-time. So we can change the speed of light or the metric locally or globally.
So when we talk about real curved space-time, you know, one of the things is that the path of light that's moving through it will be affected by this curvature. So, you know, that will be modified. And in your lab, you know, the hope is to create a material made up of sort of a chain of squids, which can each be controlled so that you can modify the path of light, the path of photons as they move through.
Yes, that's correct. So one can in principle think also of two-dimensional arrays of squids in which the path of the photon is controlled. But in our case, the system is one-dimensional. So what we are interested so far is in time-dependent phenomena. What happens when you change very fast the speed of light in some place, or when you change, when you make a change in the speed of light and move this change along the material, so to speak.
Now, Soren, obviously, you know, it takes a huge amount of energy to actually curve space-time. We're talking about things like black holes out in space that usually have enough mass to create enough gravity to curve space-time. So how can you recreate something that has a similar effect in your laboratory?
That's right. Our space-time is, in fact, an artificial space-time. It's an effective space-time that is felt by the fields that propagate in media. And the magic is coming from the strength of the electromagnetic field. The gravitational field is much weaker. Therefore, the action of actually curving the space-time, so actually curving the background that photons, for instance, would see when propagating, is indeed weak. So you need to have a lot of mass to do something that is experimentally or measurable at all or observable at all. But in the lab, because the electromagnetic field is so strong, we actually can bend this effective space-time in a much more effective way. We don't need to go to extremely high fields. We just need to use the electric fields that you would normally use anyway in a laptop.
And so how far have you got so far in kind of building this kind of material?
We can make this arrays of squids. We definitely can make them and we can study them. There's a lot of work done in characterization of these structures and in understanding actually what are their properties at microwave frequencies. And there is some work that we should do in fighting with the coherence, improving the quality of the materials. And that there is some further work that we should really think what are the limitations of, for instance, if we do experiments on propagating the bias pulses along the line, how in practice we can do this and what are the limitations and what we would realistically expect to see. But there's a lot of very interesting physics, I should say, along each of these steps. It's not like we are having a goal that is 20 years ahead. It's at each step we really discover very beautiful physics and very fundamental physics.
And so when it is all up and running, you know, what will be the sort of the first things that you plan to test, and how will that relate to our understanding of quantum theory combined with the general theory of relativity?
One idea would be to create a situation that would mimic the inflation in the early universe, in which the space-time rapidly expands, and then we should see the creation of photons. In our case, in the inflationary model, it's matter that is created and also photons. But that would be one of our first experiments to do, and we are probably not very far from that.
Okay, well, that sounds very, very exciting. Thank you very much. But I understand that you're also, you know, this isn't your only project. You're working on a number of different things. You know, at the moment, we're located in a scientific and cultural center in Arice, Italy, which is named in honor of the Italian physicist Ettore Majorana. And I believe that you have some work that a project that you're currently working on that, you know, has some connection to that in some spirit. So can you talk a bit about, you know, this particular piece of work and, you know, what's its history in relation to Majorana?
Right, yeah. So that's one experiment that we just did, and it's going to be published in New Journal of Physics. And so I have in front of me, I can show you the original paper from 1932 of Ettore Majorana. It's called Atomi Orientate in Campo Magnetico Variabile. It's in Italian, in Novo Cimento, I think. And so in 1932, there were three theoretical papers, one due to Landau, in fact, two to the Landau, one to Zener, one to Stuckelberg, and then Majorana. And they were both on the same topic about how to excite an atom from the ground state to the first excited state by sweeping the detuning of that atom. That would be the modern language in which we nowadays put these things. But the one famous formula came out from this work. It's a so-called Landau-Zener formula for transition probabilities. So when you sweep the detuning of an atom, you change effectively the transition frequency. There is a probability that the atom gets excited from the ground state to the first excited state. And Landau and Zener wrote down first this formula. And then there is a work of Majorana and Stuckelberg that is basically independently found the same formula and the same phenomena. What we did recently is that we tried to do this type of experiments, but very far in a regime which is very far from the usual Landau-Zener domain of applicability, so to speak. So this derivation of the Landau-Zener formula is within certain assumptions, and we have managed to move beyond these assumptions and do this experiment in a regime which doesn't satisfy for which the Landau-Zener formula is not applicable, in fact.
Let me stop you there and just ask you. So, you know, you're talking about the regime in which this formula was originally derived. So what sort of regime is that? What are these assumptions? And, you know, why are you testing it beyond that regime? I mean, you know, wouldn't you just assume, well, it doesn't work there, it's not applicable? What can you show by kind of pushing it beyond this limit?
Yeah, that's true. The Landau-Zener formula is an approximation which is derived basically by assuming that when you do this sweep of frequencies slow enough compared to some parameter that can be precisely identified. But you basically move rather slowly. There is a region in which there is a phase called the Stuckelberg phase, which is accumulated, and then there is a region where effectively these transitions from the 0 to 1 happens, and then there is again phase accumulation. This whole thing is periodic, then it comes back, and so on and so on. So people found very beautiful interference pattern called Landau-Zener-Stuckelberg interference pattern by doing so. Now, why do we want to go beyond this? Because slow is not always something that allows you to do everything. So we move in a regime where we move very fast from the near the transition point, in ideally infinitely fast. So we are in a completely different regime called the sudden approximations, where we just very suddenly move across the transition, and we find a different description. We are forced to give a different description of the system, which is very beautiful and simple. I mean, comparably simple with the original Landau-Zener-Stuckelberg-Majorana theory. And the reason for doing that is that in order to further advance, one should do experiments in this regime where the transition frequency of a qubit moves very fast from one value to another. Some of these experiments, there are proposals that one could do physics related to how a qubit couples to a field. Sometimes this is called the Arouk-Deville detector. So it's a very generic system in field theory where you have an atom, a qubit, a two-level system or something coupled to a field, and then you want to change rapidly something there, like the frequency of the qubit or something related to the field. If you do it slowly, you don't see, I mean, you'd see interesting physics, but non-physics. But if you do it fast, you might see something rather different. For instance, yeah.
So is this something, you know, is this something that has practical implications? Because we're talking about qubits, you know, thinking about maybe quantum computing or something. Is this something that you need to explore in order to understand how, you know, physicists might progress with building a quantum computer, or how it might react if you do, you make certain changes quickly or slowly? Or is it something that you're investigating more to understand the kind of foundational side of physics?
It's both ways. What we are doing, of course, has implications also for things like quantum computing. In fact, our qubits are one of the standard platforms in quantum computing, superconducting qubits. And this is a field which is advancing very nicely and very fast. So and that requires also manipulation of the qubits in different regimes, including manipulating the changing the frequency very fast. There is also more practical applications. For instance, the squid arrays that I mentioned, they can be also used as microwave amplifiers, just amplifiers of a signal. In our case, we are not interested so much in that, although it's a kind of nice side application, but we are interested in what happens when you want to amplify the vacuum. Effectively, we are amplifying the fluctuations of the vacuum, the virtual fluctuations of the vacuum in this experiment. So there's nothing at the input of this amplifier except the vacuum. And so, yes, it has definitely several implications. For instance, I mentioned the fact that you need to change very fast the frequency of a qubit. This can be used for additional for testing things like the Unruh effect, for example. So, yeah.
So we're talking about amplifying the vacuum, which sounds very interesting. So in quantum mechanics, you know, the vacuum, we don't think of it as being completely empty. We think of these virtual particles, pairs of particles that pop in and out of existence, and, you know, they last for just a moment, and then they annihilate with each other and they disappear, but the vacuum is bubbling along all the time. You know, why do we want to amplify that? Is that to understand more about what sort of particles are created? Could we have some use for that? Could we harness that? What, you know, is it to, you know, why do we want to amplify the vacuum?
I think this is purely for, the interest is mostly in the foundations of quantum physics. We just want to test theories that about quantum vacuum, and there are not that many tests available after all. So we just want to understand this phenomenon, and once it's understood very well and it's tested, we can think about going farther and applying it to some other phenomena or some other experimental contexts.
So what are, you know, these different theories about the vacuum? You know, what is it we don't understand, or what are people kind of disagreeing about that needs to be tested?
I don't think in the case of vacuum, of QED vacuum, there is a significant disagreement. But again, we are going back to the problem of how to treat the vacuum when the space-time is curved. So what happens when we are near a black hole, near an event horizon? Is the vacuum actually really empty, or is, like Einstein said, there is always the field that remains once you remove everything else? It's the gravitational field. Is it discrete? Is it continuous? If I would have a microscope to look at it, and to up to what level I can distinguish things in the vacuum? These kind of very fundamental questions that nobody knows how to answer.
Okay, well, no, that does sound extremely interesting. Now, we've sort of, you know, talked about the motivation for, you know, stretching beyond the limits of this formula as it was set out. What have you discovered so far?
So far, we are just experimentalists. We are just trying to see, to test theories that other people have thought about quite so long time ago. But one interesting experiment that we did is the so-called dynamical Casimir effect, which was a prediction, a very long prediction for that has been standing as a theoretical prediction for quite a long time, from the 70s. And this has not been tested before and it's very difficult to imagine a system other than the superconducting qubits or circuits in which it can be tested. And we did an experiment that shows exactly that when you change very fast the index of refraction of material, or in fact, when you do this kind of perturbation on the material, then photons get they become real. The virtual fluctuations of the vacuum are converted into real photons.
And I think we spoke before for the podcast about this very lovely experiment that you did. But in your new paper for the New Journal of Physics, you know, what are you reporting there? Is it just the idea of how to set up the experiment to test this formula beyond the limits, or do you have results yet?
No, that paper is about the... it involves an atom, let's say. It's a bit different from the Casimir effect. It's one atom in a cavity, effectively, and we are interested what happens when we change the frequency of the transition frequency of this atom. And one reason for this is that one could imagine that in order to test, for instance, the Arrhoe effect, one could change the, instead of accelerating, for instance, the atoms, which at very high accelerations, which is very, very difficult, one could imagine that you play with the transition frequency of the atom in order to create an effective time, in order to accelerate some effective time that you can define with respect to the qubit as a clock. So to test the Arrhoe effect, for instance, is extremely difficult to do it in the way in which it was designed, like having a rocket accelerating at huge speeds and having a detector that detects some thermal excitation. But if you have an atom that changes very fast its transition frequency, it can be shown that theoretically that it's pretty much the same, almost the same effect. So you would expect that the atom would be populated from the zero to the one state. And so in this direction, I think this is an interesting experiment because it shows that we can put matter into our fields and we do something that that is interesting about this matter. We can manipulate matter, we can control the quantum state of these kind of systems. And so it kind of opens the direction in which you put matter in a curved space-time. That will be the next step. And then you start to ask yourself, can you do quantum mechanics in curved space-time, in a curved space-time background?
Thank you to Soren Parawanu for chatting to Zia there.
On the podcast page, you'll also find a link to an article on his research by Nicola Jones and a podcast interview from 2013 in which Parawanu talks about experiments that use the dynamical Casimir effect to transform virtual photons in the vacuum into real photons.